Aloha. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. It's Tuesday, March 18th. We have been surveying the media landscape of late, and today we hear from Overstory Hawaii, a new voice based out of Kauai. Tomorrow we'll hear from a journalism initiative on Maui. And then there was one dairy is all we have left in the state, down from double digits back in the day. Honolulu Civil Beat looks at efforts to start another one on the Garden Isle. We explore our classical music roots as we tip our hat to the Hawaii Youth Symphony. And we talk baseball in Japan and its ties to Hawaii. Remember Wale Onamine? The baseball season just got underway over there. Tune to the conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Earlier this month, we introduced you to Aloha State Daily, a new online media organization that was marking its second month anniversary last week. Today, we hear from Overstory Hawaii. It just launched a month ago. So what makes it different from other online media? Well, perhaps it was fitting in this, the year of our community forest, that the new media outlet was launched. Overstory is a nod to the canopy in a forest. And it's on the Garden Isle that journalist, Kauai journalist Noel Fuji'i Oride, is helping to nurture the seedling. The online newsroom was given early support through the Kupa'a Network, whose fiscal sponsor is IO, the company backed by Hawaii businessman Dwayne Carisu. His media companies include Hawaii Business Magazine, where Fuji'i Oride previously worked. She joined us to talk about the story behind Overstory.
So Overstory, it's an online publication that covers the systems and solutions behind Hawaii's most pressing issues. We didn't want to just cover like the problems that Hawaii is facing, though we will do some of that. But much of our journalism focuses on how communities are responding to Hawaii's challenges. And this really follows a framework that's being used around the country called solution journalism. So this is rigorous reporting that examines the effectiveness, the lessons learned, and the limitations of various ways that people are addressing the problems they're encountering. So for us, we might be looking at local efforts that have had positive impacts on their target communities, or maybe they're actually a good fit for more wide-scale replication across multiple communities here. We might also be looking at initiatives from other jurisdictions, but there's a lot of interest in them locally. So we're not simply looking at ideas. We really want to look at initiatives that have evidence of potential, you know, evidence behind them that they'll work. And so this approach also really heavily emphasizes context and nuance. I mean, we want to understand why things are the way they are and untangle the intersections between the patterns and systems and assumptions that shape our challenges and also inform these potential ways forward. Right now, we're covering housing, environment, and health to start with, and we're publishing an article every other Wednesday. So we don't do breaking news or daily reporting. We really want to thoughtfully add to this big and sometimes overwhelming ecosystem of information that we have, and we do hope to add more coverage areas and increase our publishing frequency as we build our own capacity.
And you're based there on Kauai, but it's not just the Kauai news that we're covering here.
So we are statewide. This approach, I mean, it also really stems from our statewide community listening project. So when I was hired by the Kupa'a Network in May, right, it was really important for me that we do a community listening project, right? We hear from community about what they would want to see from a new local newsroom. And we just work on building relationships, meaningful relationships with the communities that we'll be covering. And so while we had identified our values and potential scope of coverage, we wanted to affirm that these aligned with Hawaii's information needs and also just information wants. So I was able to work with a team of community listening ambassadors to have one-to-one and small group conversations with folks in their communities. And again, this was statewide. And so we also had an online survey But most of our time was spent in these one-to-one conversations that lasted anywhere from 20 minutes to, I think our longest one was 3 hours.
Wow.
And residents told us that they're really tired of seeing so many negative stories that just reiterate how expensive Hawaii is and how more locals are leaving for elsewhere. Some also told us that this negativity caused them to disengage entirely from local news just to protect their own mental health. And along these lines, we also heard requests for stories that give people hope, right, and tell them what's being done to address these issues. Also, we believe that our communities benefit when there are multiple newsrooms rigorously reporting on matters of importance to Hawaii. And so for Overstory, we didn't want to replicate what other existing journalism organizations are doing. We saw the gap for solutions journalism and also just the declining coverage on the neighbor islands. And so our reporting will embrace the mindset that there's a lot to be learned from all Hawaii's communities, and we'll especially be keeping an eye on the neighbor islands.
We have watched over the years how local newsrooms have been cut. And, you know, I know when I joined Hawaii Public Radio, you know, it was adding staff, which was nice to see.
Yeah.
And now it just seems that there are some new kids on the block, so that our listeners and, you know, readers out there will be able to hopefully find something that they feel that they can, you know, depend on.
Yes, and I think it's a really exciting time because you're also seeing these different organizations come up to fill gaps, right? They're seeing that there's a need in their communities for this different type of reporting. And so it's just really neat to see.
Your webpage certainly lays out your story. It's very thoughtful about what you plan to cover. But talk about your staff.
Right now, on the Overstory side, it is just me as the only full-time journalist on staff. Our parent nonprofit, the Kupa'a Network, has an executive director. And so she and I work together a lot to look at Overstory's vision and just how we can continue best serving our communities. We will be offering opportunities for folks to freelance for us. And we've been able to do that a little bit so far through our community listening project. We had some wonderful freelance illustrators who are working with us to create these beautiful illustrations to accompany our articles about this project.
And so how about funding going forward?
Yes, Overstory is funded as a program of the Kupa'a Network, but we are responsible for seeking out our own grants and donations. And so like with other new nonprofit journalism organizations that have been created around the country, we'll be following that model, right? So a mix of grants and donations. You know, one other way that we're different is that we're very upfront about our values and our ethics, right? We follow the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics and some of the Institute for Nonprofit News' standards for editorial independence and financial transparency. And all of our ethics policies are on our website. And so that was important to me and to us as an organization because we do believe people deserve to know what journalistic standards we're upholding ourselves to and also just how we do our work. We do have a copy editor who is helping us to edit some of our stories. And we have also been using co-publishing partnerships. So we've co-published one of our first stories on housing cooperatives with this national newsroom called Next City. And so they've also helped us a lot by providing some editing support too.
And you also got, what, some seed funding?
Yes, the Listening Post Collective. They provided us with a grant so that we could do our community listening project. So that enabled us to work with the community listening ambassadors and pay them so that they could have these community conversations and just spend time, right, building relationship with folks and getting to know their communities and getting to know the issues that they care about most. With this grant, I mean, we thought it was very important to share back what we learned through this community listening project. And so that's why you see on our website several stories about how this community listening project is informing our journalism. So we had one story that was kind of an introduction and an overview to this project and how it shaped like the solutions focus and how we're also going to be especially looking at the neighbor islands. We have another article about how the community listening is shaping our housing and our health coverage. We'll have another one about our environment coverage, and then we'll also be releasing a final report, I would say, in probably the next month too, just to kind of tie everything together. And so through this grant, that's how we've also been able to work with some freelance illustrators to commission some artwork to accompany these articles.
And talk about the title. Talk about how you got the name, Overstory.
So Overstory, I will admit it took us quite a while to come up with a name for the journalism program. We wanted a name that had a connection to nature, and Overstory draws from the uppermost layer of Hawaii's native forest. So in this layer, it's predominantly made up of ohia and koa trees. And this vantage point, it reveals more than just a canopy, right? I mean, scientists can use it to get a very broad overview of entire watersheds and species diversity and forest health. And so our journalism really follows the same principle, right? We examine Hawaii's challenges from a systems level and revealing how different elements interconnect and influence each other. And so this perspective also helps us identify pathways towards potential solutions that honor both people and place. And it's interesting too, because our logo is an apapane, a native bird, right, that has a very symbiotic relationship with a forest overstory. And as the apapane pollinates ohia blossoms, it helps to sustain a forest vitality. And kind of similarly, our journalism aims to cross-pollinate ideas and solutions across communities and foster meaningful civic engagement and community involvement. Another way that we're different is that as we were doing our community listening project and hearing some of the comments about what folks care about and how they want to see journalism done a little bit differently, I mean, it got us thinking about what our journalism is in service of. And so we created this statement, and it says that our journalism is in service of a more equitable and restorative Hawaii. So we envision a Hawaii where Native Hawaiians and Kama'aina can afford to stay and thrive here. Alala Hawaii and Hawaiian culture are flourishing. Hawaii's land, water, and air are healthy and have meaningful reciprocal relationships with the people who call these islands home. And Native Hawaiian stewardship practices are abundant. And all residents have equitable access to privileges and opportunities. Journalists are often told to distance themselves from the issues and people that they cover. But at Overstory, we really approach our work with the mindset that our journalists are also part of the communities we serve. And so we care about Hawaii. And this doesn't mean that we'll be advocating for one side over another in our articles. Facts and accuracy remain our priority, and we are committed to integrity, editorial independence, fairness, transparency, and democracy. But Overstory, it's really a way for us to show that we care for Hawaii, and we're trying to give people hope with accountability by connecting them to effective approaches and useful information that can just help them understand something better or meaningfully get involved in their communities. And we also hope that it helps. We hope our articles help others just grow their love and care for Hawaii and its people, too.
All right. Well, Noelle, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been hearing from Noelle Fuji-Oride, who launched Overstory Hawaii just about a month ago, though it's been in the works since last spring. You can find her work at overstoryhawaii.org. Listen up, everybody, if you want to take a chance.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing on Maui to help break the cycle of poverty for residents experiencing homelessness, such as HomeAid Hawaii. NereidHawaii.com.
If your pet gets sick and needs medication, you go to the vet, right? Well, in Spain, it's not so simple.
Está inflamadito y tiene secreción.
A new Spanish law restricts the use of antibiotics to treat animals. We'll hear about the impact of that law next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from HMSA, celebrating over 85 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Got milk? Well, today we take a closer look at our dairy industry, or at least what's left of it. Honolulu Civil Beat's Brittany Light joins us today. Good morning, Brittany.
Good morning, Catherine.
You know, I was so surprised to learn about Hawaii's dairy industry because we had, choke dairies, particularly here on Oahu.
Yes, there were 160 dairies at the height of the industry across the islands. And now there is just one on the Big Island.
Yes, but you got wind of efforts to possibly start a second one.
Yes, so Alun Farms, a prolific grower of vegetables in central Oahu, in the last few years has sort of targeted its agricultural growth over on Kauai, in West Kauai. And the latest from them is they have a plan. They want to establish a dairy in West Kauai, which is, to start, it would be around 500 acres.
Well, you know, this may be news to a lot of people because, you know, folks are very familiar with Alun Farms, particularly here, you know, on Oahu. But we understand that they have also been prospering there on your island.
Yes, so they've been growing vegetables in West Kauai. They purchased Kauai shrimp late last year, and now they have this plan that is still in the very early stages, but it would, establish a dairy on Kauai. And I think this is, you know, it's interesting for a lot of reasons. One is that it could, you know, sort of reverse the steady decline of the milk industry in Hawaii by adding, doubling the number of dairies in the state. But also, Kauai had a dairy proposed on the South Shore years ago, and about 6 years ago, that plan totally collapsed amid some litigation from environmentalists, resorts who, you know, were worried about the environmental effects of cow manure and also the smell.
Right. They were downwind and downstream of something that they prefer not to be. And that was the one backed by Ulupono, right?
It was. This was Hawaii Dairy Farms, which was Ulupono. Yes.
Well, so, the whole idea is that, you know, there's been great effort to try and help Hawaii become more resilient and more or less dependent on imports. So I guess we'll see. I mean, you said this was very early on. We don't have a lot of specifics, the details on this?
We don't have a lot of specifics, but broadly, Alun Farms is proposing to establish a dairy that would use, you know, it would be modeled after New Zealand style of pasture-raised, sustainable dairy farming, they say, similar to the dairy style that Ulupono had proposed. What's different, I think, is the location. West Kauai is, you know, through and through an agricultural region. There's lots of dormant farmland, waiting for someone to invest in it. And, it's not near these mega resorts that were really concerned about flies and the stench of cow manure and all of those things.
Well, yeah, you want to support this idea, you know, of another dairy possibly, but you do want to know what the facts are.
Yeah, so, I mean, Hawaii right now imports more than 90% of its milk, and we are only Alaska trails behind us in the amount of milk production. Alex Sue, who's the president of Alloon Farm, says his goal would be to have a carton of milk from this dairy cost $3 to $4. That's definitely lower than prices these days if you go to the grocery store.
Yeah, and they are, you know, trying to get support from the lawmakers.
Yes, so they're looking for some taxpayer-backed loans to get this started. It's really capital-intensive. It would cost about $6 million just to establish a dairy on Kauai. You know, other challenges are they would want to grow their own feed, so there's some challenges around that. And just getting, I think, the community to embrace this idea of a dairy, you know, on the heels of this other dairy plan that failed and really was quite controversial.
Yeah, we'll see if they can get buy-in the second time. But thank you so much, Brittany. Really interesting.
You're welcome.
All right. We have been talking with Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Brittany Light. You can read her story online at civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership, providing full-service wealth management on Oahu, Maui, and throughout California. Learn more at thericepartnership.com.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories as they happen. Catch The Daily, Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30. Here on HPR One.
Support for HPR comes from Manoa Valley Theater. The musical drama Parade tells of the 1913 trial of Leo Frank, a Jewish American accused of murder. Opens this Thursday, manoavalleytheater.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. The Conversation will be on the road in Waimea on Hawaii Island for a live taping this Friday, March 21st. So, for today's backyard quiz, we're focusing on this cozy ranching town. The town's name translates to reddish water, which refers to the runoff from the red soil that's present after heavy rains. It may be best known as the home of Parker Ranch, the largest ranch in the state. And while locals and many Hawaii residents know the town as Waimea, it's also known by another name, Kamuela. The U.S. Postal Service uses Kamuela as the official name for the town because there are two other Waimeas in the state, on Kauai and Oahu. And there are other places in Hawaii with two names. For instance, Ka'ohau on Oahu is more commonly known as Lanikai. But for today's backyard quiz, we want to know, how did Kamuela get its name? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing solutions for homeless residents living on the island of Maui, such as Home Aid Hawaii. NereidHawaii.com.
The Hawaii Youth Symphony has had a busy 60th anniversary season. Student musicians played alongside the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra last week in a side-by-side concert as part of the orchestra's Beethoven Festival. We looked at our own rosters and found four former members of the Youth Symphony on our staff at HPR. Government reporter Ashley Mizuo, operations manager Crystal Spear, Classical Pacific host Shireen Lumtaba, and Kanakapila Sunday host Louise King Lanzalotti. Lanzalotti played the cello in the very first iteration of the Youth Symphony. Spear was an oboist in the group in 2019. The Conversation's Maddie Bender brought all four of them into the studio to reminisce on their early orchestra days.
And so my first question, and I'll start with you, Louise, is why you decided to join in the first place, whether it was your parents or yourself, kind of what your origin story was.
I was in orchestra, and my conductor, Mr. Mesrobian, was also the conductor of Youth Symphony. And in 1962, I don't think he had enough strings. So he took us little eighth graders, or seventh, I'm not sure what, and he put us in the back stand. It was such a great thing to do. So he talked me into it. It wasn't hard. I loved it.
Shireen, you go next.
Mr. Miyamura was the conductor, and he asked me to join, and it was really a great decision. I don't know what I'd be doing. My life really kind of took a path from that moment, and I'm so grateful to Mr. Miyamura and the Youth Symphony. I still to this day play in orchestras, and I'm a little better, not much better. Sometimes worse, but it is still fun. It is still the best seat in the house.
Ashley?
Yeah, I started in HYS because, well, I had auditioned a few times before I got in. Actually, I would just always completely just crumble under the pressure during auditions. And so I had auditioned a couple of times and I finally got in my junior year of high school. And a lot of it was due to our teacher, Miss Ochi Onishi, who really pushed me and really made me the best player I could be at the time.
Your music teachers keep coming up that they were so instrumental.
Yeah, Miss O is like second mother, yes. I think, to like most oboe players in Hawaii, I would say. And even my younger brother, he's 6 years younger than me, he came up with Miss O as well. And she's just been such an important part of our lives.
Crystal, what about you? I also had the Miss O special. I started taking lessons from her in sixth grade when I started playing oboe. And she, I think, still is, and at the time was the YS2, one of the YS2 conductors. So I auditioned for HYS, I think, when I was a freshman in high school, and I got into CO. So it was a couple years till I was actually in her orchestra. But one of the CO conductors was my middle school band director. So sort of like both sides, I had teachers and leaders who were encouraging me to join. And so it was just like a natural progression of the band kid experience.
I'm wondering, does anyone remember their audition piece?
Definitely blacked that one out. It was just kind of like an intimidating experience because you would go in and then there would be like the two or three judges and their backs are faced to you. And then they would have like sometimes a screen, but they would instruct you to be like completely silent because they don't want to know who's playing, except a lot of them were like our teachers. So they probably knew exactly who the person was that was playing. Yeah. And it was just really, I would always just get so nervous before them.
To me, there's something so special about having that audition experience as a young person, because we do a lot of scary things, a lot of auditions as adults, but getting that experience in a low stakes environment seems like it could be, yeah, a real educational experience. So Ashley, talk a little bit more about the role that played in your development.
Yeah, I actually think that out of everything, I mean, obviously the music was like a huge part of it, but another big part of it was definitely that kind of character building. That was kind of my first exposure ever to doing something really intimidating, that you have all the nerves, you're scared, and sometimes you have to be in front of a lot of people. And that's really translated, I think, to my career today here at Hawaii Public Radio as a news reporter, taking those chances, those risks, and being able to use your voice and stand up. The foundation of that was really rooted in my time in band and orchestra and doing those HYS auditions as well as practicing and all of that really just lays the foundation, I think, to really build your character at a very young age.
Yeah, I feel like I have to say this one time that music and the whole band experience is probably the most formative thing I did as a kid. Yeah, like Ashley said, I feel like that experience definitely molded my character and work ethic and ability to get along with other people and form relationships. And so it's a huge, huge experience for young people, I think.
Shireen and Luis, I wonder how the two of you feel hearing Ashley and Crystal talk about something that, I mean, decades after you both were a part of it, does it seem like they had similar experiences?
Well, first of all, listening to them is making me nervous.
I have like pre-concert jitters.
Well, you know what's different? As a string player, you play in a section. So the experience of a wind player with solo parts is such a different, it's a different world. And for us to hear that is amazing, right, as string players.
Well, you know, I hear a lot of differences because when I was in Youth Symphony, there was only one orchestra. And once you got in, you were in, but you did have to audition each year for seating. And I would agree with everything Shireen said, except that in the string sections, if you were in the first chair, you had a lot of responsibility, which was really, really important. It was good for us. It made us more responsible. We had to go and correct the bowings and everything. And also, I was a cellist. I didn't mention that. So Mr. Mesrobian used to let me conduct sometimes when he went back to listen, to listen to all the sound, because I told him I wanted to be a conductor. And in those days, girls, girls didn't be conductors, but he would let me do that. And so it gave me so much more confidence. And to this day, it's the only kind of music that doesn't make me nervous. I hated performing. I loved cello, but I hated performing. But conducting, not even get nervous, and you're hearing all this music all over the place, and it's just fun.
Are there particular pieces that any of you remember playing? We can go around. Let's start, Luis.
Absolutely. I fell in love with Beethoven when I was in orchestra, and we played the first and last movements of Beethoven's Fifth. We did really excellent music, but also the variety of music that we were exposed to was very useful for later. It made me sort of almost a step up when I went to music school. I'd already done a lot of the orchestral music history. I knew a lot of the composers, but Beethoven, just, I fell in love with Beethoven.
I do remember we played the William Tell Overture. We also, I don't know if it was the same year or a different year, we played the New World Symphony by Dvorak. And I only remember these pieces because there are oboe or English horn solos, and those are the only pieces that I remember because they were important to me. I do remember also that Mr. Elton Masaki in YS2 always picked fun pieces in addition to like the very classical pieces. So I think one year we did like a Legend of Zelda music.
Oh, that's awesome.
Piece, or like we did like a Super Mario like video game piece as well. And so those are fun too.
I don't know. When you think about young people listening to classical music, there isn't always that sense of excitement or fun. But when you're in that setting with other young people, it feels differently than when you're in the backseat of a car with your grandparents and they're listening to the classical radio station.
Yeah, because it is different playing it rather than, I think personally, I would not listen to classical music now or at all if I had not been a part of the orchestra. You just learn to hear things in a different way. You can identify the different instruments. You can be like, I played this before, or I played this composer before, and I can hear these things. But yeah, what really makes it special now for me is listening back to maybe a piece that I played in HYS and remembering the experience and like that feeling of like working so hard with all these other young people towards this common goal and having this finished product that you all do together. It's like such a special thing.
I felt like that music was ours when we practiced it, and it's still mine. It feels like I was in high school in the 80s, and this is, I am a Sony Walkman person back then. And on my tape would be like the Beatles. It would be Michael Jackson and be Bach, and it was all like the soundtrack to my teen years. And so, yeah, I was a really awesome teenager.
Shireen and Luis, you both are music hosts. Are there definite points where, like, oh, your understanding or appreciation of classical music from orchestra ends and your day job begins, or do they all kind of flow along the same river?
Yeah, it's all the same. And I have to say, I listen to music until going to bed, and then it's the first thing I do in the morning, and it's what we talk about when we're eating. And I think music has been the heartbeat of my life. Yeah.
One more go around. I want an anecdote or a moment, just something from your time in the orchestra.
For a little while, I was in the front stand, and Mr. Mesrobian would be conducting. And when we were playing certain music, the cello part was not always that interesting. So I would start filling in the notes and sort of improvising and fooling around. And I just remember him just side-eye looking down. He didn't say, stop it. He just looked down and he kind of like, hmm. And then he went back up like, I hear you.
I guess the main one that comes to mind, and this isn't necessarily during the time that I was in HYS, but it was when I went to Pacific Music Institute, which is their summer program. You would get to do like an ensemble performance with just your section. And so just be like actually like 15 oboe players and like three people playing English horn. And you would play these pieces that were, I don't know where Miss O would find them, but one of them I just remember so specifically was a Journey medley, and Journey's like her favorite. And so I just remember 15 oboes playing this Journey medley, which is so crazy, but that's just like one of my favorite moments, I think, of high school, honestly.
Glee could never.
They could never.
My first day of youth symphony, we didn't have a car to transport the harp. But my Uncle Gus was a yard man. So for those Sundays, we would stand the harp on the back of his pickup truck alongside with his lawnmower and rubbish cans. And this was before the advent of bungee cord. I don't know, but it was tied with a rope. And I mean, we came from Pearl City all the way to UH on a Sunday, which is a busy day for yard men, right? But he took off those days. And so my dad and my uncle would like carry the harp in. We didn't have a cart. We were so ill-equipped for classical presentation. And then we're all sitting, the three of us, in that seat, right, of the pickup truck. And what an experience. And then the first day, Mr. Miyamura said, I want to tell you that Shireen Lum arrived in a pickup truck that had a lawnmower in it. Oh my gosh. And I sit in the back of the orchestra, like teenage me was back there, and then all the faces turn to look at like, who came in a what? Oh my gosh. It's amazing. I showed up the next week. It was so embarrassing. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that families and parents do of athletes and musicians. And it really takes not only the organization and those teachers, but those families that sign up for that and show up. It's really heartwarming that it's continued.
And yet you still married a bass player.
It continues.
Yeah, well, Uncle doesn't drive us around anymore. Thanks, Uncle.
Oh, my gosh. Just love that segment. We were hearing from HPR's Ashley Mizuo, Crystal Spear, Luis Lanzalotti, and Shireen Tamba. They were talking about their time in the Hawaii U Symphony with our executive producer and clarinetist, Maddie Bender.
Mester's father went to Costco every Sunday. He bought everything he could, whether he needed it or not. I think those piles were kind of the money made flesh.
Yeah.
His spending habits tend towards physical objects and a lot of physical objects. Yeah, like a physical manifestation of, you know, having enough.
A daughter, a father, and a family struggle with American bulk. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
Living on Molokai for many means few options for work and high costs for food and other daily essentials. More and more island residents are turning that challenge into opportunities to revisit cultural knowledge and practice self-sustainability. We'll share how on episode 4 of HPR's award-winning podcast, This Is Our Hawaii. Tune in this Sunday at 4 on HPR 1.
And now it's time for the answer to the backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the cozy ranching town of Waimea. It is officially recognized by the U.S. Postal Service as Kamuela. As with many places around the world, it's because there are towns with the same name that are close to one another. In the continental U.S., there are 91 places named Washington. And here in Hawaii, there are 3 recognized Waimeas, one on Kauai, one on Oahu's North Shore, and the one on Hawaii Island. We asked you how Kamuela got its name. Kamuela translates to Samuel, and most believe that it's in reference to Samuel Parker. He was the grandson of John Palmer Parker, the founder of Parker Ranch. And if you live in Waimea, don't forget to join us for a live taping of the conversation in Waimea this Friday, March 21st. I'll be interviewing Manu Minute host Patrick Hart live on stage, along with author and veterinarian Billy Bergen. Join us for a fun evening of discussion and music. Go to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org, for more information. And as far as the winner for today's backyard quiz, William from California, who grew up in Hawaii, he got it right, and he says he's looking to move back to Waimea. We hope you do. Major League Baseball is back. The first game of the year was played in the middle of the night last night, local time. The Los Angeles Dodgers beat the Chicago Cubs 4-1 in Tokyo, Japan. A small piece of history was made during the game. For the first time ever, 2 Japanese pitchers faced each other on opening day for the U.S. Major Leagues. It was 30 years ago this summer that Hideo Nomo started a trend that continues to this day. Japanese players moving their professional careers to the United States. After Nomo came Ichiro Suzuki, leading up to today's superstar Shohei Ohtani. Did you know professional baseball across the Pacific has a history that also involved Hawaii? Before former Cubs outfielder Kotsuke Fukudome threw out the first pitch at last night's game, HPR's Jill Dorman spoke with Robert Whiting, a Tokyo-based author who's written 10 books on Japanese culture and history, including several on baseball.
This is the 6th time Major League Baseball has opened its season in Japan. This year includes baseball's most dominant player, Shohei Ohtani. What else makes this significant?
There are 5 Japanese players on the field. There's 3 on the Dodgers, 3 pitchers in their starting rotation are Japanese, and then there's 2 Japanese on the Chicago Cubs, Imanaga and Seiya Suzuki. People in Japan used to think, you know, years ago when I first got here, that a Japanese player could never make it in the major leagues. It was just an impossible dream. Every other year, an American team would come to Japan and play a postseason series of goodwill contests, and they would always defeat the Japanese team handily. I can remember the manager of the Omiuri Giants, after one such series ended, saying, "There's no difference between the ability of Japanese and Americans in playing baseball. The Americans are bigger and stronger, that's all." And then here you have Shohei Ohtani comes along. He's 6'4", he weighs 230 pounds. He throws the ball 100 miles an hour, and he hits 500-foot home runs. He's bigger and stronger than most major league athletes, and he looks like an NFL wide receiver or linebacker. So you could say they've reached their aspirations for defeating the Americans in baseball.
From the U.S. side, from Nomo to Ichiro to Ohtani to many others now, it's been nothing but growth. But what's this done to the Japanese side of professional baseball?
Well, there's a basic difference between the Japanese professional game and the Americans. The American game is based on profit. Teams have to turn a profit, and they have to win in order to turn a profit. But in Japan, the teams are created as advertising vehicles for a parent company, like the Nippon Ham Fighters are owned by the Nippon Ham Pork Manufacturing Company. They use it for advertising, and it's a kind of tax write-off. And I've been told that it's cheaper to buy a baseball team and have the company's name, parent company's name, in the sports news every day on newspapers and TV than it is to buy advertising time in prime time in Japan. They don't have extensive farm systems. They don't invest in the growth of the team the way they should. So that's why these players like Sasaki and Ohtani go to the States, because the rewards are far greater. Nobody in Japan was going to pay Ohtani, you know, give him a $700 million contract like the Dodgers gave him 10 years, or the 12-year $325 million contract they gave to Yamamoto. The highest paid player in Japan makes around $6 million a year. That's it. It used to be considered an act of national betrayal to go to the States. That's why Nomo was considered a traitor. And Sadahata Oh, the great home run hitter for the Omira Giants, had 868 home runs in his career. He wanted to go, but he said, I never could, because the fans never would have forgiven me. You know, the goal at that time, he's talking about the 60s and 70s, was to beat the Americans in a real World Series.
A lot of people don't realize that some paths of baseball in Japan run through Hawaii. Down to the first U.S. player to play in Japan after World War II. He was from Hawaii.
When Japanese baseball fans think of Hawaii, they think of Wally Onomine. He was the first foreigner to play in Japan after the end of World War II. He was a three-sport athlete from Maui. He played for the San Francisco 49ers for a year. He was a running back. He went over there in 1950. In the beginning, Japanese authorities thought they'd made a horrible mistake, because the Japanese people viewed Nisei, American Nisei, as traitors, because they'd fought alongside the American soldiers during the war. And so there was a lot of animosity towards him. And also, he introduced the rough slide into second base to take out the second baseman and break up a double play, which was something Japanese didn't do. It was impolite. But, you know, he helped the Giants win several Central League pennants and Japan Series victories. He won some batting titles and MVP awards, and he was accepted. He, you know, before Onomine came, if a Japanese batter hit a ground ball to the infield, second or short, they wouldn't run it out. They just figured it was an automatic out. But Onomine ran, you know, even the most routine ground ball to the infield, he ran as fast as he could, and sometimes there was an error and he got on base. So he changed the way they play. And he went on to become a manager, and he introduced some American concepts of training. The Japanese had turned baseball into a martial art, and the basic theme is practice until you die. They had this drill called the Thousand Fungo Drill, in which a player was fielded ground balls, hit to his left and right, back and forth, until he dropped from exhaustion. There was a famous manager at Waseda University who grafted the philosophy of the martial arts onto baseball, the samurai ethic, and who famously said, and it's only when the player is lying on the ground, flat on his back, froth coming from his mouth and semi-conscious, that you can say he has practiced hard enough. And the idea, you know, if you wanted to be a good pitcher, you're expected to throw 100 pitches every day in practice. That's like throwing a complete, you know, nine-inning game every day.
What about just cultural aspects, connections, anything with baseball, U.S. and Japan that's changed over time?
I think the average Japanese baseball fan prefers to watch Major League Baseball rather than the Japanese leagues if there are Japanese on the team. You know, they'll tune in. It's a matter of, you know, national pride to see a Japanese succeed in America. They're gratified by seeing that. I think there's, all in all, this migration of Japanese players has been good for international friendship. Because of the intense coverage of Japanese players in the States, Japanese got a closer look at American society than they would have normally. So there's a, you know, a cultural awareness that's improved. You know, it's a learning experience, so people, I think, feel closer to America and Americans than they did before. So when I first came to Japan in the 1960s, all anybody talked about was the Yomiuri Giants. Every game they played, the entire season was telecast nationwide. You walk any bar, restaurant you walk into, the TV there, the game would be on, or get in a taxi, the cab driver would have the radio blaring the game. The Giants used to get 25 million viewers for every game they played during the season. And that's like a 20 plus on the Nielsen, Japanese Nielsen rating. But it's fallen down. Now it's down to single digits, and you very seldom see a Giants game on network television. They're on cable now, but the viewership is down to like 200,000 or 300,000. The Japanese, still, they will go out of their way to watch a Japanese play in a major league game. And Japanese corporations buy sponsorships and advertising in big league parks. Some telecasts, you can see signs that aren't really in the park, you know, be on the backstop behind the catcher. They'll have a sign, you know, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. Right. It's not really there. It's just superimposed on the screen, you know, for I don't know how many millions of dollars they had to pay for that. But it's generated a lot of money all around.
That was HPR's Bill Dorman talking with Tokyo-based author Robert Whiting. Tickets to the games this week in Japan are generating a lot of money. Resale agent StarHub was apparently selling seats behind home plate for 1.7 million yen, or more than 11,000 U.S. dollars. Wow. Well, that does it for us. We're out of time. Up tomorrow, we continue our tour of the state's new journalism outfits. We turn our eyes to Maui. Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.